Good day, eh? Welcome, welcome to the Offbeat Oregon History column dedicated to Oregon, the southernmost province of, Canada, eh? The Great White North. We're the southernmost part of the Great White North, eh? So take off, you hoser. Okay, that was a really bad Bob and Doug McKenzie impression, I have to admit, but I had to do it because this archive column today that we're going to be talking about, hardly anybody knows this, but Oregon came within a whisker of becoming a part of Canada. In fact, if it hadn't been for a failed expedition in which a bunch of people died and a bunch of people lost money, it was a disastrous failure, and it, quote, saved the state, which otherwise would have become an officially a British province. And I'm going to tell you the story about that in just a half a minute here. First, I better introduce myself. My name's Finn J.D. John, and it's Monday, May 21st, and you're listening to me reading you a column from the archives of the weekly newspaper column I write, Offbeat Oregon History. I do this every day, and of course, if you're subscribed to the podcast already, you already know that. And if you're not subscribed to the podcast and want some more information about it, it's free, of course, check it out on offbeatoregon.com. As for today's article, it ran in the newspapers for the first time on August 8th, 2010, under the headline, How Oregon Almost Became Part of Canada, eh? All right, here we go. The story of John Jacob Astor's Pacific Fur Company expedition to Oregon in 1810 is remembered today, if it's remembered at all, as a dismal failure. Dozens of people died, his ship sank, and he ended up selling Fort Astoria to the British at a severe loss. But what most people don't know is that if Astor's explorers had stayed home, the Oregon Territory would probably be a Canadian province today. Here's the story. The Astor expedition left shortly after Lewis and Clark got back. It involved two journeys, one by land and one by sea, to the mouth of the Columbia River to set up a network of trading posts there. The project was ill-starred from the start. The ship Astor sent around the Horn, the 94-foot, three-masted windjammer Tonquin, was captained by a tactless, arrogant ex-Navy officer named Jonathan Thorne. Thorne, when he got to Astoria, insisted on sending a rowboat out to scout the channel immediately despite the heavy seas. And by channel, I mean the mouth of the Columbia River. The one that goes across the famous Columbia River Bar. Yeah, that channel. So the first boat was never heard from again. The second boat was almost lost, and a third finally managed to locate the channel for the Tonquin, but swamped and sank before it could get back to the ship. So the Tonquin sailed into Baker Bay and founded what's now Astoria. Then it put back out to sea and headed north, making for the Russian colony of Sitka. It never made it. Thorne's personal style had infuriated not only his passengers, but also every native tribe that came to trade with him. This last item proved fatal when, during a trading on Vancouver Island, he had the local tribal chief chucked over the side of the ship, apparently thinking the soaking would get him to lower his asking price for pelts. So the next morning the natives were back and told Thorne they'd learned their lesson and they were now ready to deal, and they were very sorry to have inconvenienced him the previous day. But once on board, they got out knives and proceeded to avenge the insult to their chief. The next day, one of the survivors touched off the powder magazine, and that was the end of the Tonquin. There was a huge explosion. The remaining surviving members of the crew, who were very few and mostly injured, were gone, and a bunch of natives that were on the ship were gone as well. But by then, he had done quite a bit of damage up and down the coast. Thorne's bargaining style had not only cost the expedition its ship and left the surviving Astorians stranded in the wilderness, but it had angered natives all along the coast, pretty much everywhere they had stopped. The people the Tonquin had left behind to found Fort Astoria on the northwest tip of what's now Oregon had lots of fences to mend, and many of the natives clearly didn't plan to leave them alive long enough to mend them. In desperation, Pacific Fur Company partner Duncan McDougall pretended to have a, quote, bottle of smallpox, which he would uncork if attacked. This kept them alive, but made them even more friendless. Meanwhile, Astor's overland expedition was working its way westward, more or less along what would become the Oregon Trail years later. The overland party fared a little better than the seafarers, in no small part because of the presence of Marie Dorion and her family. That's a whole nother story, Marie Dorion is. Things went relatively well for them at first, but about halfway through the journey, the overland party, like Captain Thorne's Argonauts, fell victim to arrogance. This time it was the French voyageurs in the party. Overconfident in their skills as river navigators, they convinced the rest of the team that they should give up their horses and take to the river. Henry's Fork, which drains into the Snake. Now, anyone familiar with the Snake River's reputation for navigability, or lack thereof, can guess what happened next. They found themselves stranded in the middle of the Snake River Desert in what's now southern Idaho, next to an utterly non-navigable river, the horses all long gone. Well, most of the overland crew did manage to straggle through, one way or another, but they only beat a rival British expedition by a few months, and they utterly failed to establish a credible land route. With the Tonquin gone, the British in control of the high seas, and the War of 1812 breaking out, Astor gave up and sold out to the British. Well, now we get to the funny part. A month after the sale was completed, a British warship arrived and, quote, seized the newly purchased Fort Astoria. When told that he was seizing British property, the captain replied that his orders were his orders to seize the fort. An order was an order, and he was going to seize the fort. This probably struck many people at the time as one of those sort of amusing little bureaucracy stories, but it was going to turn out to have ramifications that no one imagined at the time. And that's where we get to the interesting part. When the war ended, part of the negotiations centered around the Oregon Territory and who would get to claim it. Feeble and isolated as it was, Fort Astoria was American when the war broke out. It wasn't sold until after hostilities broke out. Moreover, the fort had been seized by military force, although not from the Americans, so that made it technically a spoil of war. The war-ending treaty involved returning all spoils of war. So the Astorians briefly got it back, although they immediately turned around and returned it to the people they'd sold it to. I mean, after all, a deal was a deal. But the important part of all this was that when the peace treaty negotiations got underway, both America and Britain had a credible presence in, and therefore a claim on, the Oregon Territory. So when their status was made official by the resulting treaty, the first of several joint occupancy arrangements were made. Joint occupancy is what led, under the pressure of thousands of American homesteaders in the subsequent decades, to Oregon and Washington becoming part of the U.S. rather than Canada. But if the Astorians had not been in Oregon when the war broke out, or had sold their holdings to the British before the war got started, there wouldn't have been any Americans in Oregon when the war started or ended, and the treaty that ended the war would almost certainly have defined the British and the U.S.-British border, making Britain's claims on Oregon official. And we'd all be speaking Canadian today, eh? That's it for today. You've been listening to an Offbeat Oregon History Archive column. If you'd like more, there's hundreds of columns from the last 4 years on our website at offbeatoregon.com. On the website, you can also subscribe to get these podcasts delivered straight to your smartphone every day via RSS or iTunes, or join the conversation on the Facebook page or Twitter feed from links on the page. Also, if you found this column on iTunes, if you wouldn't mind taking just a quick second and writing a review of it, that would be wonderful. Small podcasts like this get successful primarily through the pressure of good reviews. So, of course, if you hated it, see, this is my evil scheme. See, I make this pitch at the end of it, and if you hated it, you've probably bailed out on it long since. But seriously, I'd sure appreciate it if you would do that, if you've got the time. Also, this column is covered under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license. See offbeatoregon.com/cc for details. And if you're ever up in Corvallis and have time for a cup of something, look me up. I love geeking out with fellow history buffs, especially if there's coffee and or good Irish stout involved. Locally brewed good Irish stout, I guess I should have to say, because we've got a bunch of breweries in town now. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, @offbeatoregon. And one other thing, my book is coming out on June 5th. It's called Wicked Portland, The Wild and Lusty Underworld of a Frontier Seaport Town. And if you like this podcast, chances are pretty good that you're going to like the book. I'd like to invite you to take a look. The website's up, so you can check it out. It's at wicked-portland.com. The website's designed to work with the book. You're supposed to read this book with a smartphone in your hand so that it can cue up assets in color and in motion and sound. That's all I've got for today. So have a great day. Thank you.